Across Divides is a podcast that discusses challenges faced by communities around the island of Ireland. In this season, we're taking a deep dive into Carlingford Lough and the Shifting Tides Project, connecting coastal communities between the shores of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We speak with scientists, artists, and communities about the different ways they understand the sea, exploring creative approaches to protect it. Learn more at theshiftingtides.org. The shores of this island are thriving with life. Seals slick among kelp forests, and seabirds drop in an instant from the sky to the depths. Seagrass meadows teem with octopus, and bright sponges cling to rocks with the sea stars. It's possible to celebrate this wondrous diversity whilst also recognizing the threats towards it. Globally, about 30 to 50% of marine habitats are thought to have been lost, damaged, and destroyed by dredging, trawling, pollution, and development, with the rate of destruction accelerating in recent decades. 90% of big fish have been removed from the sea, and the largest commercial fishing boats are going further and deeper in search of the smallest catch. Supporting the recovery of marine life will take a concerted effort all around our coasts, restoring marine habitats so that communities of creatures can grow and thrive to continue as intricate and beautiful connected systems of life. Richard Nairn is a writer and environmental scientist. His book, Wild Shores, follows the coasts of the island of Ireland, seeking out the wild places and the creatures that live there. His account of our shores is one of a changing seascape.
A year ago, I took my boat for 5 weeks and I went harbour to harbour, all the way around, complete circuit. So I saw at first hand a huge variety of areas. We have a wonderful coastline in Ireland, being a small maritime island, complete contrast between east and west, with rugged west coast and north coast and very tamer east and south coast. And there are issues on all of them which are to do with impacts on the landscape or the seascape and on all of the things which live in the sea and on the shore. And there are plenty of examples of that. I guess starting with the habitats like sand dunes and salt marshes, which are on the low-lying east coast mainly. And then in the area of the marine species, we've plenty examples of marine animals which have been overexploited over the years. I mean, think of lobsters, for example. There are whole areas of the coastline which are devoid of lobsters now. We've had various fish stocks that have been overfished, such as herring, cod, and so on, which in some cases the population has collapsed. And this still goes on today. Fish like sprat are being hoovered up and turned into pet food. Things like seed mussels, which are dredged from the seabed, tiny little juvenile mussels, which are dredged and brought back to aquaculture areas and grown on to commercial size mussels. There are places where they've completely scoured the seabed bare of seed mussels and there's none left. And Carlingford Lough is one of those where they dredge sea mussels.
In the face of enormous biodiversity loss, effective management strategies can allow marine environments to recover. Many fish species have been shown to bounce back when the pressure put on them is reduced or removed. But conflicts can arise where conservation priorities are misaligned with commercial practices and coastal livelihoods. Still, when things are done well, it turns out there can be benefits for marine creatures and the people who depend on them for a living.
I'm sure there are limitations. For example, in terms of overfishing, it does mean that in some cases, areas would need to be put aside. We call them marine protected areas, where there's strict protection of marine life. And that would mean that fishing activity would have to be restricted or moved elsewhere. But there are examples, small areas such as Arran in the Clyde, where the Lamlash Bay there has been the subject of a no-take zone for many years. The results have been monitored carefully by university scientists, and they found that biodiversity has increased by about 50%. But not only that, that after some years, the species that were being taken, like scallops and lobsters, are 2 to 3 times higher after protection than they were beforehand. And secondly, that there's a spillover from those protected areas to the surrounding areas, so that a harvesting of shellfish benefits from having conservation areas. And there are plenty of other examples of that in the UK and in other European countries. It's just we haven't quite got around to it yet. So I'd be optimistic that if the fishing community can be persuaded or is willing to compromise, that there are solutions that will work for both biodiversity and for fisheries.
We'll come back to Richard in a while to hear about his vision for nature restoration across the island of Ireland. But first, let's head to the East Coast and a body of water that lies right on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. As we have already noted, management plans for the sea can be difficult, especially given they are dealing with an environment that is fundamentally fluid. While marine protection measures often mark out areas for marine life to recover, it can also be difficult to draw lines in water. This is Robert Walsh, coordinator of the Northern Ireland Marine Task Force, a coalition of non-government environmental organizations working towards healthy, productive, and resilient seas for Northern Ireland.
It's a lot harder to do marine spatial planning due to the dynamic nature of the marine environment. And for Carlingford in particular, it's an even more such a challenge because you're dealing with two different jurisdictions.
Robert explains that the challenge of designating marine protected areas is not just because the sea is shifting, but so are the creatures within it and indeed the climate.
We all know that with migratory species, that these species cover massive distances, and you can have the impact where, unless you're accounting for protections in one location, where they move to the next, could be, if you don't have something in place where that first port of call is before they continue their migration round, could be the link between whether they continue to thrive or if they further decline as they move around. So a perfect example of that is that every autumn winter we receive the brake geese in Strangford Lock, and then they'll slowly move around towards Carlingford as well. But if we didn't have the sites in Strangford Lock to look after those, they've then got to travel even further to get to the next available spot. And it's even more important, this marine spatial planning, as we move into an uncertain climate, because we're going to see shifts in presence of various species, you know, not just whales, but your sharks, skates and rays, your seabirds, the availability of prey items for those species to support themselves will also change. And we need spatial planning in order to account for where that's going to have the most influence, where we're going to see areas of maybe refuge, areas of critical degradation.
One strategy for ensuring this patchwork of protection is the designation of marine protected areas. These are zones where human activity is limited so that marine species get a chance to recover. Anna Murtagh is the Marine Protected Area Officer for Newry, Mourne and Down County Council.
In short, my role is managing the implementation of the marine protected areas. So we have three. We have Strangford Lock and Murlock, and then Carlingford as well.
Anna outlines how marine protected areas can allow marine life the space it needs to find balance with human activities.
There is different levels of marine protected areas. They can vary from no-take zones, highly protected marine areas, basically the whole body where nothing can really be allowed to happen. And so what marine protected areas are put in place to do is to help species recover, to help plants, habitats, everything get back to a level that we can use. And I think in theory is that we should be able to live in harmony with the ocean. we can use it, we can benefit from it. A lot of us benefit from it, but we also must respect that we need it to thrive and we need it to survive for us and for future generations.
In 2022, at the COP15 meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity, a strategy was proposed to protect 30% of our seas by the year 2030. The 30 by 30 goal has since been adopted by governments and organizations all around the world, including the European Union and the United Kingdom. But putting these measures in place has proven a challenge, and countries are already slipping behind on targets. Implementing marine protective measures on Carlingford Lough has an added complication. A border runs through the middle of it. But Anna is optimistic about the possibilities for shared learning about marine protection between the shores of Carlingford Lough.
At the end of the day, the goal is the same. I think having two sets of councils or two sets of bodies working on something together could end up creating a lot of great ideas.
Anna picks up on one of Richard's points. A lot of livelihoods and recreational activities rely on the ocean, and it's important to find a balance. As she's already mentioned, it's crucial that human life is able to coexist with a healthy sea, and she needs the input of people from around the shores of Carlingford Lough to develop better plans for its protection.
I personally don't live in Carlingford, so I know that as much as I can read everything about it, I don't know the real life issues that are going on every day, what the communities face and what they're not happy with. So I would love to talk to anyone who has any sort of issue with the lock or what's happening. And I think for that, a fundamental point for me will be to base off what the local issues are, what the people are saying in terms of protecting it. Because we can put in stuff to protect the habitats and to protect the species, such as even the light-bellied Brent goose. That's a really important species that we're looking to protect. The terns, the red shanks, but also just the local issues day to day. What have people noticed that have changed for the worst? What are they finding that they're not happy with in the lock? It's the small changes that hopefully, once we're aware of, we can start to put in place protection measures.
Coastal communities are intricately connected with marine environments. Policies for environmental protection that don't take this important point into account can risk further alienating humankind from the oceans. Let's come back to Robert Walsh.
The stakeholder that really at the main point of this are coastal communities as well. They are right on the doorstep of change that is going to happen through climate change. If coastal erosion is managed poorly, they are going to be the people who bear the brunt of poor management practices, poor enforcement. So there's a lot of people that we need to get this right for, not just for marine life, not just for industry, but also for the heart of coastal communities.
During the summer of 2024, Shifting Tides held a number of engagement events around Carlingford Lough. We invited Robert to meet with community members and discuss their concerns and priorities for effective management. He outlines some of the main points that were raised during these sessions and some of the key learnings that emerged.
So, understandably, given the situation in Northern Ireland with Lough Neagh last year, some of the concerns went to water pollution, especially in terms of raw sewage entering Carlingford Lough. You've got things such as how our marine protected area network is connected up correctly as well. You've got the presence of seagrass and the impacts of aquaculture as well, and basically looking at how discharges may affect those industries and those habitats. The concern of some maybe destructive activities that take place, such as the influence of bottom trawling on seabed habitats as well. So it's been quite interesting from that kind of physical perspective. But then we've also had highlighted to us a bit of an inequality in terms of knowledge and gaps that we have there. So in terms of what we refer to as ocean literacy or our understanding of the marine environment, education can sometimes be quite poor, even with coastal communities and certainly with politicians in maybe not knowing different habitats and what takes place and the importance of those. And I think it's really, there is a concern from an education perspective that the marine environment is out of sight, out of mind, and that it's a very dynamic, it's a difficult environment to really manage, but that nevertheless, we should be learning and educating ourselves and educating in the wider circumstances to better understand, because there are people who care. You've experienced that through Shifting Tides. There are communities that really, really strongly care about the lock. They live there, they breathe it in, they understand it. But people that are maybe not from that area, they don't understand the cultural importance of it. They don't understand the heritage. It is that they won't protect what they don't understand. So widening the net, pardon the pun, of our understanding will help to address some of the threats and pressures.
Valuing local knowledge is key to any effort that connects community needs with conservation goals. People's lived experiences of the sea are central to how we understand it and how we look towards building movements to restore marine environments. When initiatives are supported to be led by communities, they often have sustainable foundations and strong outcomes. In Richard Nairn's new book, Future Wild, he explores active restoration projects around the island of Ireland, which show us how natural habitats and native species can be restored sustainably for the benefit of everyone. The goal of nature restoration is to allow ecosystems to repair themselves, either with human assistance or by just letting them be. This doesn't necessarily mean returning to a vision of the past. Restoration projects can evolve to develop ecosystems that grow and change into the future.
I think it's very important. It's the two letters RE in RE in restoration, which may make people think that we're trying to recreate something from history. But I don't think that's possible or even desirable, that we should be trying to create something that was present in medieval times or something, because it's just not feasible in today's modern intensive land use and coastal use. What we have to do is to try and nudge the natural environment in a direction that's more sustainable for the future. And that's for the benefit of everybody, for wildlife, for people, and also, very importantly, as nature-based solutions for climate crisis that we find ourselves in. Salt marshes connect to absorb storm energy, which comes in onto the coast at times, and we're getting increased frequency and intensity of big storms. So salt marshes and sand dunes have a role in absorbing that energy. Another example would be seagrass beds, which are a huge sink for carbon in the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide, as we all know, is one of the major sources of greenhouse gas that is causing rapid climate warming. So by protecting and hopefully expanding seagrass beds, we're actually providing a kind of dual purpose solution. It's good for biodiversity in the oceans. It's also good to ameliorate the climate issues.
The European Union has adopted a nature restoration law that aims to restore nature in EU member states by 2030 and 2050. The law includes targets for restoring degraded land and sea habitats, pollinators, agricultural ecosystems, urban areas, rivers and floodplains, and forests. Restoration can take particular focus on important species or habitats, which often have knock-on effects. For example, reintroducing beavers can have significant impacts on rivers and the creatures that live within them. Restoring forest habitats can lead to positive changes not only for trees, but the countless species that rely on them. In marine habitats, coral reefs, salt marshes, seagrass meadows, and mangrove swamps have all seen restoration efforts to bring back healthy ecosystems. And, as Richard explains, oysters.
The one that jumps out at me straight away is the native oyster, because at one stage, almost every bay and estuary in Ireland, particularly the sheltered areas, had beds of oysters. And these are the native oysters, not the introduced Pacific one. And over several centuries, they were absolutely devastated by basically harvesting. Local people would go out at low tide and collect the oysters in huge quantities, and they were then exported mostly to London and Paris and places like that, to the point where they almost became extinct. There were just a few surviving small patches in Galway Bay and I think Tralee Bay as well in the southwest.
Native oysters are so-called ecosystem engineers, filtering and cleaning water, sequestering carbon and contributing substantially to inshore biodiversity by creating reefs that become spawning grounds and nurseries for young fish. Introducing Cara Bradley, Marine Conservation Officer at Ulster Wildlife.
Basically, the difference between our native European oysters is that they are originally from here. We used to farm those here up until the early 1900s. They still are farmed in Loch Foyle, but all the other fisheries closed down in the early 1900s. Everybody used to eat them. They were abundant, but due to overfishing and pollution and disease, they sort of got wiped out. Pacific oysters were then sort of brought in probably the 60s or 70s to sort of fill that gap. And the Pacific oysters are a different shape. So if people eat them, they'll see that they have quite a concave shell that sits quite nicely. The oyster sits quite nicely and it's easy to eat. They're sort of like teardrop shape, whereas our native flat oysters have a very flat shell on one side and then their second shell has a bit of a concave. They are also round in shape rather than the teardrop kind of shape.
Cara explains that native oysters evolved with many of the species that live in our local seas, so they inhabit a specific niche in marine ecosystems. They are ecosystem engineers, and restoring them can have enormous benefits for marine life.
We have set up oyster nurseries in Belfast Harbour, Bangor and Glenarm. We have them in baskets or cages. They are all individually set in little layers. We then tag them and then it means we can keep an eye on them. We can check their growth, check their weight, make sure they are surviving, make sure they are growing. By checking their weight, we're able to see if they're spawning. So over summer, when water reaches a certain temperature, they will spawn. And that can happen once or twice over the summer. So we keep an eye on their weight to see if they are doing that. But from like Bangor's been in since 2022, we're seeing little spat on the oyster shells. So we can see that they are spawning. And the idea is eventually we'll be able to put ones onto the seabed because we know they are surviving, we know they are spawning, we know the water's all good and it's good to go basically for them.
The hope is that native oysters begin to settle on the seabed, spreading out and forming reefs that will proliferate over time. And the work being done by Ulster Wildlife isn't the only example of oyster restoration. In Scotland, the Sea Wilding Project on Loch Craignish is a community-owned venture that has set out to restore native oyster beds and seagrass meadows. Community members are involved with surveying the loch, rearing oyster spat and seagrass shoots, and introducing them to the seabed. Their hope is that the project has benefits not only for the marine ecosystem, but that it leads to a sustainable community fishery too.
Our next goal is seagrass and salt marsh. Blue carbon is a big thing at the minute. Your marine recovery, your nature-based solutions. With the seagrass, the oysters help that as well because they filter the water, which means that the water is clearer, which means the sun can get through the water to the seagrass because they photosynthesize as well. Those are our next things that we're going to work on.
Blue carbon and nature-based solutions are terms which refer to the capacity that marine systems have for mitigating the effects of climate change. The need for restoring marine habitats is therefore an urgent one, and it emphasizes the ways in which complex and diverse ecosystems can be resilient to change. They are interconnected communities of seagrasses that hold the seabed steady and produce oxygen for creatures that swim amongst them, oyster beds that filter the water and keep it clear so sunlight reaches the depths where anemones blossom and lobsters crawl amongst the wrack and kelp. The importance of such interconnectedness and resilience might also go for coastal communities, for people whose livelihoods, culture, and way of life are closely connected with the sea around them. The intro and outro music for this podcast are from the Mind Orchestra and the Library of Congress Archive. The mysterious transitions are drawn from Karen Power's composition, Hidden Life of Carlingford Loch. You can hear the full piece in the Soundwaves episode in this series, along with conversations on citizen science, rewilding our seas, stories of smuggling and seaweed foraging. Throughout the series, we also gain insights on creative approaches to community-led marine conservation and hold challenging conversations about balancing coastal livelihoods with protecting our seas. To get involved with Shifting Tides and access a wealth of online resources, visit theshiftingtides.org. Shifting Tides is a recipient of the Creative Climate Action Fund, an initiative from the Creative Ireland Programme. It is funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media in collaboration with the Department of the Taoiseach. The fund supports creative, cultural and artistic projects that build awareness around climate change and empower citizens to make meaningful behavioural transformations. Shifting Tides is a project under the umbrella of the Wheel and NICFA's iCommunity programme supported by the DFA, the Shared Ireland Civic Society Fund. iCommunity seeks to support the community and voluntary sector on the island of Ireland, working together on common issues such as community-led climate action. You can find out more at iCommunityHub.org. Thank you for listening.